Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And in the intro, you mentioned that you were that you basically took on the job from Ian MacDonald. I mean, Ian MacDonald did Revolution in the Head, which you've made quite clear is the template for your book. But actually, he was down to originally write that book, wasn't he?
He was.
And before he died.
And he wrote some amazing pieces along the way that you could tell were going to be part of the book. I remember one about Station to Station. I can't remember what magazine it was in. That was brilliant. I'm sure Ian will be turning in his grave at the idea that I've taken over his project. What happened was that he and I have the same editor, and it just came up in conversation one day, and the editor said, you know, we never found out when Ian died whether there was a manuscript. And he said to me, would you be interested if there was a manuscript that was 95% done and having a look at it and seeing whether we could do anything with it? And I said, sure. Went away and thought about it and started to get excited. And then he came back and said, no, absolutely no manuscript. And I said, but me, it's mine. It's my project. I want to do it now. and that's what happened.
So there was no actual start on the book. There was no kind of entry for Space Oddity or whatever. I mean, he just made some basic notes.
As far as I know, they couldn't find anything at all, no, so...
This is, I should say, actually, is the Word podcast, isn't it? And on my left, the mighty Peter Doggett, who was in not long ago, talking about his tremendous Beatles book. Welcome, Peter.
Thank you.
And Fraser Lurie at the controls, and the equally tremendous Paul de Noyer.
Hello.
A Bowie enthusiast and specialist. And Peter's written a book called The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 70s, which I'm glad we sorted this out, because I came into the office this morning saying, I look at this, which is terrific. Well, I've read the whole thing. I said, but there's no mention of China Girl, one of my favourite songs. And Fraser said, I refer you to the title of the book. Do not lead with your... Make sure your opening question is not, why isn't China Girl in this book? But anyway, it's out. And the thing that struck me very early on in your terrific introduction is the complexity of Bowie's family. I mean, in fact, there's an interview in the next edition of Word with Max Hastings, who says, no successful person ever comes from a happy childhood, which is quite an interesting point. And if you think, we talked about this a lot in your Beatles podcast, the lives of Ringo Starr, of Paul McCartney to some extent, and to a great extent, John Lennon, and how... to the extent to which they were driven to go on and achieve things and settle scores. But in Bowie's case, explain, if you can, the complexity of Peggy Burns and John Jones, his parents, and the children they'd already...
Oh, my goodness. It would be easier to be Rolf Harris and have a flip chart and be writing family trees and stuff. Both Bowie's mother and father had children elsewhere, illegitimately, as far as I can recall, before they came together. The mother got pregnant before she and Bowie's father were married. As a result of all this, there were two older half-sisters. I'm never sure what's the difference between a half-sister and a stepsister. Anyway, two older sisters.
That's right.
And an older brother.
And one of the sisters was just given away immediately.
That's right.
Abandoned. I don't think Bowie ever saw her or heard anything about her. The elder one, I think, was in the family at some stage, then out of the family.
Yep.
And then there's Terry Burns,
the famous older brother, who was, I think, eight years older than David, and had an enormous influence on him at very impressionable times of his life. In his mid-teens, he came back from the services and was available to rescue David from South London, this very tiny little house that... various friends of Bowie's from that period have described to me as being, you know, cramped and dark, and they have this television in the corner with the 2-inch screen, you know, dusty, absolutely no sense of joy
at all. Yes, very kind of fetid and claustrophobic. Mm, yes.
That's right. And his older brother, Terry, was able to take him out into Soho and say, well, look, these are cafes, this is existentialism, this is beat literature, this is jazz, all of which, you know, at the age of 14 and 15, he's bored at school, he's sort of compressed at home, no real ambitions apart from maybe playing rock and roll, and suddenly he's got the world opened up to him. And I think it's really important that he got that learning from a family member rather than from school, because the big thing out of, I think, Bowie's whole life is that he's self-taught. He's an autodidact. And he's picked up influences along the way. And he's, certainly in the period I was writing about, is absolutely desperate to accumulate new knowledge, new experiences, new people, new writers, new art, yeah, new music. And he's not satisfied until he's got everything.
Well, we'll come on to the school bit in a minute, because that's equally fascinating. Peter Frampton's father is a lecturer. But, Paul, we were talking about this earlier. Terry Burns, his half-brother, is an incredible influence, isn't he? He's the one who, I think, turns him on to Coltrane and Kerouac and takes him out to the... as Peter was saying, to Soho.
Yeah, so I wish we could know more about it. Bowie is obviously not especially forthcoming. He has occasionally talked about things, cultural things, which his brother introduced him to, as you were mentioning, particularly that the life of Soho and jazz and so forth. What we don't know so much about, and speculative biographies have been written about this, is the emotional influence on Bowie of his brother's mental decline. Terry, had severe mental difficulties, although apparently a very bright man and so forth.
Yeah.
But he was very, very troubled, and he was put away in a mental hospital in South London, somewhere around Croydon. And I forget which year this, but eventually he checked himself out and effectively killed himself, didn't he, on the railway line. Yeah. Near the hospital.
Right.
In fact, if you look at the cover, maybe just the American cover of The Man Who Sold the World, there is a sort of eerie silhouette of a building behind the lone gunman. And this cover is doubly creepy because the image of the lone gunman put one in mind of all those stories of assassins who would turn up on American campus.
Absolutely.
Premises, yeah. But also the building behind is actually the mental hospital that that Bowie's brother Terry was incarcerated in. So, we don't know for sure, really. I mean, perhaps Bowie will tell us if he gets around to writing his book. But clearly, having idolised his older brother, the effect of watching the state deterioration of Terry must have been something, must have been something significant in Bowie's own mental landscape.
Yeah. Well, Peter, you mentioned the intro again, quite rightly. I mean, it's very easy to look at somebody's kind of body of work and bring in all manner of analysis. But one of the points you make is that his confusion about this sense of kind of belonging and identity if you come from such a complicated family. And the other is this sort of obsession and probably fear of inheriting, because the schizophrenia, I think there are other members of the family who had been schizophrenic.
Aunts and so on.
And
The family legend is that his mother told him at a young age, all my side of the family go mad, so basically you've got no escape. And then he sees his much loved brother.
Probably a mistake,
brother.
I would have thought. Tell a small child.
Imprinting
that this
the child,
was their destiny.
Yes. Yeah.
I know. No, it's I didn't realise how much he was influenced by him. I mean, he really idolises him, doesn't he? He's about how old? 6 years older than Terry, was he?
I think I said, eight, I think.
Eight years.
And as a toddler, they're sharing when Bowie's a toddler, they're sharing a room, so they've got that bond from when he's very young. And it sounds as if it was a very affectionate relationship. I mean, physically, you give him a hug, whereas you don't get that impression about the parents at all. It's a very cold, distant, old-fashioned English upbringing. Children in their place.
Yeah.
So the real sense of belonging that I think he gets from his brother is very important. And then when he's there's a sense in which that's the only sort of stable and interesting bit of his family life. And then when that starts to fall to pieces, I think he stepped back from it very, very much. And I'm guessing, I'm not David Bowie, but my feeling is that he tried very hard to forget how important Terry had been to him.
Yeah.
But that influence was inescapable. It kept coming back to him the whole time.
Yeah. Well, we can get on to the sort of family substitutes. I mean, later on, he kind of moves in to Ken Pitt's place, he's his early manager, possibly to escape the family home and all the complexities of things that were going on. But another point you made, which I thought was brilliant, was about how in your Beatles book... you talk about the Beatles perfectly defining an entire decade. Their story starts at the beginning of the 1960s and it ends, I think it was on the 4th of January 1970. Perfect.
Yeah.
And you make the same point about this. Well, this is particularly why you've chosen to confine the book to the 70s music of Bowie, that Bowie sums up the 1970s. But you also make the point that he was very out of step with the 60s. What did you mean by that? Because he was how old was he? He would have been 13 when the 60s
started. In lots of ways, I say in the book, he was in the perfect position, because in 1963, he leaves school, he's a pop star of sorts in the borough of Bromley, or you know, in Bromley and Beckenham. He's playing in a band called the Comrades. He gets girls after him, I'm sure. And he also gets a job in advertising in the West End in Bond Street. So, I mean, he's the king of London, he must feel like. And he keeps coming across managers and producers who say, "I'm going to make you a star, son." And each
in
one...
that accent, in fact.
Probably, almost certainly. Yeah. And each one of them fails to do that ignominiously. Partly, I think, because he couldn't fix upon what he was supposed to be, and so he was always trying to be what he thought other people wanted him to be. He would be changing himself to fit a format. And so by the end of the 60s, at the height of the sort of counterculture, when everybody else is waving flowers and Uzis or whatever they were, you know, whether they were into drugs, love or revolution, he has more or less...
Flowers and Uzis. Great album title, never mind.
He's more or less retired from the scene. He's more or less given up. His first album comes out in 67, and he does nothing to promote it. I mean, there's nothing available. There are no gigs, no tours, you know, no films, nothing. His career comes to a complete halt at the point when it should have been taking off. And so I think he went into... I can't say he was depressed, but his career went into a depression from which he only emerged... by accident, really, with Space Oddity.
Well, he writes the most extraordinary things. He wrote a rock opera in 1968 with a theme of suicide.
Yeah.
Strangely, it was not taken up by anybody and actually produced. But also, you forget how many groups there were. There was the King Bees, was it? The lower third? The Conrad.
Yeah,
we
had a crack at just about everything that was going, including hippie. He was a hippie for a fortnight. But nothing with him ever seemed to go terribly deep. He was just sort of, you know, to use one of the many cliches about Bowie, he was sort of trying on costumes from his dressing up box. He was trying out identities to see what fitted. But in a sense, he never did belong to the 60s, as you say, but he really did belong to the 50s. I always think of Bowie as really a Tin Pan Alley creature from 1950s London. He really belongs to Denmark Street, which is where he first started scuffling around and finding these bands like the King Bees, even the Small Faces. You know, he was hanging around with the early Small Faces. But that was a 50s kind of world, even into the 60s. And I think Bowie, for a long time, did see himself not as a singer-songwriter of the Dylan generation, but as a kind of jobbing songwriter who would place his work with other people. If he couldn't be a star himself, he would write songs for other people. And this was his plan for quite a few years until, almost to his own surprise, he actually began to take off with Hunky Dory and Ziggy Stardust. He did see himself as somebody who would write songs for proper stars like Peter Noon and Lulu. because he'd pretty much given up all, having tried in the 60s and failed to become a 60s pop star. I think he thought, that's it for me. And then things began to change in the 70s, as you say. That's where Bowie suddenly locks in with the times. Mm.
But I think he also had the theme in his head of being an entertainer throughout as well, that he was very much in love with that tradition. I make quite a lot in the early stages of the book of the Anthony Newley influence. Now, everybody always talks about Anthony Newley and says, Anthony Newley, full stop, file it away. But nobody ever thinks about who Anthony Newley was, and he was the original polymath. He was writing films, he was doing TV comedy series, he was making records, he was a great songwriter, writing stage musicals, doing absolutely everything he could within the realms of entertainment. And I think he was very much the sort of artistic mentor for Bowie.
You make a really
60s.
Good point about him. And well, Paul's in fact interviewed Bowie, I think, 3 or 4 times. We should talk about that later. But we said that Bowie has this way of putting on this Anthony Newley persona when he deals with the media, which is that kind of cheeky London chappy. That kind of, here we go, it's all getting a bit serious. It's just a bit of fun. It's just a laugh. And no, he obviously was extremely influential. Mm. But another thing which has fascinated me in the book was about his job in advertising. Again, I've forgotten this completely. We all know that Andy Warhol was in advertising. We all know that Andy Warhol, began manipulating other images and using this whole idea of kind of spin, I suppose, and modification in his art, and had a very kind of academic view of it. But Bowie must have been obviously very attracted by and learnt a lot from the notion of that you could present something in six different ways. Or you could come up with a load of different ways of persuading people into a particular mood. I mean, it must have affected his work, presumably.
Definitely, because he was 60, a very impressionable age when he went. And although some biographers and even Bowie himself occasionally have said, oh, I was only there 5 minutes, he was there for a year. And that's a long time, even if, as I think was probably the case, he spent most of that year actually designing costumes and new ideas for his own band rather than for, you know, what he was actually supposed
to
do. Which
band would that have been?
That's the Comrades moving into the... What's after that?
Describe King the look of the Comrades for people who can't remember. There was that one who played at alto sax in, I can't remember now. It was longish hair.
Not that long hair at that point.
The R&B band?
More like Tommy Steele. No, this is more like an Irish show band, something like that.
Oh, yeah, there was good Tommy Steele, of course. I know
He's doing songs like, let me think, hits by Joe Brown and Brian Hyland and maybe something as raunchy as Gary U.S. Barnes. Nothing, nothing harder than that. Definitely not R&B.
Is there a YouTube of him? Do you remember, Paul, he appears on a television programme sort of campaigning for long hair or something?
Yes, campaign against cruelty against long-haired men. Yes, on these utterly spurious news items that Pathé News would concoct.
Yes, from Chubbly Warner, wasn't it?
They
found some young lads here with hair on their ears.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes.
That's rather sweet. He would have been about how old in that? 14 or 15 or something?
Maybe 17.
I think one of the people in that clip is Jimmy Page as well, who's there.
Oh, is he
ride.
Really?
Yeah. He'd obviously met, as you say, Denmark Street.
Brilliant, but he would have thought of this as a brilliant promotional opportunity. Obviously.
Yeah, except he wasn't promoting anything.
Oh, right. He was just promoting long hair.
It was unfortunately the gap between long gap between two singles.
He hadn't thought it through, really.
And so, he wasn't going to make that mistake with Ziggy Stardust. The album came out when The Image came out.
That, in a way, that reminds me of the way that he belonged. His head was still in the 50s, but we didn't really find himself until he swept his hair back. I think it's interesting if you watch, going ahead to the 80s, if you watch Bowie in the film Absolute Beginners, because in that I think he plays the future as he expected it to be in the 50s. Ziggy Stardust is Bowie kind of putting away the 60s, saying, 60s never happened. Let's pretend it's the day after 1959, and Ziggy Stardust is this quasi 1950s sci-fi trash rock and roll figure. And that was one of the things that helped Bowie to get ahead of everybody. You know, everybody else was still kind of stuck in the Beatles era in the 60s. Bowie's the first one who really came along and kind of abolished all of that. You know, look, 60s never happened. You know, this is the beginning of everything.
He was terrible at the 60s. You're right. I'd forgotten. He was a hippie very briefly, very unsuccessfully, wasn't he? Very unsuited to long hair.
Well, he wasn't a follower. You know, he didn't really fit when he tried to follow anybody else. It wasn't until he could sort of lead everybody that he finally found himself, I suppose.
And he formed what they call it, a turquoise. No, it's a trio with Hermione Farthingale.
Also known as Feathers, yes.
Became Feathers. Yeah. When they were a duo, when he started going out with Angie Bowie, I think, and Hermione didn't see the funny side, left the group. Musical and personal differences. Was she good? She wasn't called Hermione, was she?
Yes, she was. Yes. It wasn't her real... Hermione Farthingale.
It wasn't her real name.
Wasn't her real name, unfortunately.
See, that's so disappointing.
It is, yes.
I always thought that's why, you know, that time people were going out with these, wonderfully titled members of the aristocracy. Well, I assumed she was. What was her real name?
Oh, I don't know. I can't remember.
Hermione Rowbotham. I've no idea.
No, probably was. Probably was. No tapes of that stuff exist.
There are, and they're very, very twee, very fey.
Yeah, there's film footage
really?
Of it. Yeah.
What does that? What does it look like?
You can see it on YouTube. There are very, I don't know, what would be a kind of lighter pentangle or something would be a reference point. But again, it looks ridiculous in hindsight because it's patently Bowie not following his own agenda, but being a sort of second or third hand copy of other things which are going on. And no, it's not until the sheer strangeness of Hunky Dory that he began to be entirely his own man. Although the greatness begins, I think. I can quite see why you would concentrate on the 70s, Peter, because the truly great work of Bowie begins in the 70s and ends, I think, more or less ends in the 70s as well.
So where do you think it begins?
Man Who Sold the World. I love everything that Bowie's done before the 70s. And, I mean, I love all those Anthony Newley things, and I love a lot of his recent stuff as well. But the great stuff is the 70s. Man Who Sold the World is the first real astonishing.
Why does that come into focus so clearly for you?
I think because I think because partly because it's the most sophisticated heavy metal record I've ever heard. It's to a large extent it's a Tony Visconti Mick Ronson record. Mm. The musical side of it is fantastic. It's about as powerful as the first Led Zeppelin album or something, which it's roughly contemporaneous. But the persona that Bowie's invented for this record, this not madman but mentally distracted man. With one foot in music hall and one foot in the mental hospital, to be crude about it, is such an extraordinary character. That combined with the sheer power of this music, created largely by, as I say, by Ronson and Visconti. That was the first. I didn't hear it at the time. Nobody did, unfortunately, because it was in this kind of wilderness period in between being a one-hit wonder with Space Oddity and then beginning to re-emerge with Hunky Dory. So, like most people, I found this out retrospectively.
But that's true that it found an audience quite quickly because there was a whole generation of people who didn't want the Beatles and they didn't want Cream and they didn't want the Incredible String Band and they just wanted something new that they could call their own.
You say quite quickly, but in Bowie's life, there's a huge gap between Space Oddity in the late summer of '69,
and success,
and then success with Ziggy. Which, there is no success then until Starman. I think I discovered that Hunky Dory topped the Virgin Megastore chart or something in start of '72, but that probably meant nothing. That was one shop. It didn't chart. It wasn't a hit. He had nothing in America either. I mean, the man who sold the world, just as you say, Paul, came and went.
Yeah.
We got some great reviews in America, particularly. Right. They picked up on it, but I mean, there was no follow through. Also, I'm really struck by the audacity of the man. If we look at him through the '60s, desperately scurrying to catch up, then you would imagine if he was that desperate to cling to stardom in '69, he would have done a whole album of Space Oddity.
Played safe, exactly.
He could have done a cover of him in the year 2525. He could have been Mr. Spaceman. Instead of which, the next record he does, there's the Space Oddity alias David Bowie album, which is very dark, mostly songs about sort of doom and gloom, the end of civilization, which is not what people who bought the single wanted. And then The Man Who Sold the World, which Paul has described very eloquently. I mean, this incredible heavy metal record that anybody who heard any of his previous incarnations would not recognise.
Yeah.
And that doesn't work. And then suddenly, what's the next thing you hear? Changes. I mean, talk about changes. Just in terms of the sonic changes of your music.
Yeah.
No attempt made to gather up the previous audience and bring them along with you. Now, you can get away with that later in the decade when he's a superstar, but when you're not famous and you're still doing that, I think that takes enormous daring or stupidity.
No, that's a good point. It's such an exciting time, though. There's a great photograph of Bowie arriving. We published it in Word recently, of Bowie arriving at the Hammersmith Odeon for the last of the Ziggy Stardust concerts. And he's getting out of... Do you know the picture I mean? He's getting out of a limousine. And around him are all the faces of his fans who've been waiting just on the off chance that he might drive up that side alley and go through the stage door, which eventually he does do. And it's absolutely terrific. He must weigh about 8 stone, It's just this skinny little guy. He's wearing, one would say now, ill-advisedly, a denim bib and brace, dungarees, and a tremendous pair of stack heels, and everyone's got their little Instamatics trying to take pictures. But the best thing about it is the look of the people, the look of his fans, their faces, they are in absolute awe and astonishment, as if he isn't real. Mm. Now, I think there's a certain familiarity with people. You get to see any amount of YouTube, and they're always in the papers, and you feel that you can feel your life and your head full of their constant presence if you want to. But then to see just a fleeting image of him, and he's alive, this little tiny guy, and it's absolutely thrilling. And as you say, just so far ahead of his time.
And there are two or three themes you could pick up on there. I mean, you said how skinny he was. I mean, he's down to, by 74, when he's on the Dick Cavett show doing Young Americans, he's about 6 stone. And
yes, that's bad, isn't it? He's wearing a baggy suit, but the suit is even more baggy.
Yeah, that's right. It makes it look worse.
Absolutely ridiculous.
And I've quoted two or three people in the book who talk about the difficulty they had getting any food down. I mean, he would not eat. He was too busy. And I'm sure maybe other substances helped.
I think he had some appetite suppressants. Yes, possibly. Pumping through his system.
But he would not eat. His staff would make him a meal. And he'd say, oh, yeah, great. Or I want the most expensive steak on room service. And then he wouldn't touch it because he'd have to write 4 more film scripts and do 3 paintings and write 10 songs before bedtime. But I can't go to bed because I've got to write another film script. What about the steak? Oh, no, order me another one. And he wouldn't eat that either.
Have you ever met him?
I haven't. Now, I should say at this point, Paul has done one of the all-time best interviews with Bowie.
He has. Well, don't feel bad. People very rarely do meet him. He hasn't given that many interviews, certainly. Paul, you've interviewed him, I think. You've interviewed him about, I think, three times.
I've met him four or five times, I think. I've been lucky that each time I've interviewed him, it's been pretty lengthy. And more fortunately, perhaps, they were generally retro interviews. You know, often people give an interview because they want to talk about the new album. In my cases, he was up for talking about back catalogue. He was doing the Sound Vision tour once. Another time he was, I don't know, he'd agreed to talk about the 70s and so forth.
Yeah.
Which was fortunate for me because it gives you, you know, something much more substantial to ask him about. He's a treat to interview, you know, extraordinarily intelligent man, very eloquent. But at the same time, as you mentioned before, he's perpetually on his guard against over-intellectualising.
I know.
He's like a lot of rock stars, perhaps. He's extremely intelligent, but he didn't have that much of a formal education.
Yeah.
He's an autodidact. He's read thousands and thousands of books, but he's not accustomed to that thing which those of us who went through the university process are accustomed to.
So is that a false modesty about his intelligence, or is that his lack of confidence?
It's defensiveness. Partly it's a way to fend off the nonsense, the idiotic theorising which people like him have to put up with all the while. And partly I think it is defensiveness. He doesn't want to be caught off guard by some smart ass who's been to college, apparently getting the better of him by being cleverer with words than he is.
I find that kind of thing heartbreaking because, you know, Paul and I have sat through many rock awards shows where very bright people get up on stage and you're expecting them to make a tremendously eloquent and considered speech and just go, oh, thanks once for Derek who helped us out with this.
I know, it's so disappointing.
So great. And Debbie, all right, let's all go and get pissed. You think, but you're really clever. Why is this?
People are really scared.
He's a genuinely clever guy. I agree with that. I mean, I've only interviewed him once and very, very briefly, only for 10 minutes actually. And he was at a very down period of his career. He was actually promoting some art. Do you remember in about 1994 when we were at Mojo and I was doing a big piece about Anton Corbijn?
Oh, yeah.
He had agreed to talk about Anton, but he was standing in front of one of his pictures at the Flowers East Gallery and feeling very unconfident indeed, you know. But you know, he was just so bright and so kind of lucid. And yet, at the moment he started to come up with something that threatened to be an interesting intellectual construction, he would then just deflate the balloon and sort of just laugh it all off.
Yeah, that's when he will go into his Brixton Dave or Bromley Dave persona, just so that he doesn't appear to be getting too pompous. It's a reflexive mechanism that
But did
he
you uses. Find him also unbelievably kind of charming and upbeat? I don't know if maybe that's he's always like that or not, but I just couldn't believe it. I thought maybe he had exegesis or something. He was so happy and smiley and enthusiastic, and was that just a phase that I met him in, or did you find him?
I don't know. Something which bedevils Bowie all the while is no matter how he appears, no matter what mode he's in, everybody assumes it's an act. If he's friendly, it's because he's decided that morning he's going to be friendly Dave. If he's deep, it's because he's decided to be deep.
Yeah, because
Dave.
He's a chameleon. They're made up. They're shifting.
Changes, as we used to use every other headline for every Bowie piece. So he is kind of beset by this perception that he is. And that does remind you of somebody who has gone through that kind of exegesis. But I don't think he has, not to my knowledge. I mean, this may be just the way he is these days. But he does seem... he's not a natural, really. Even when he's being very friendly and informal, I think there's something slightly tense about him. And
what struck me was that in the same way as in 1965, 66, Bob Dylan adopted the pose of, huh? What? Who said that? To the press.
Yes.
The Bowies is the opposite, the charm you've both talked about, both described, and the winning way in which he's prepared to agree with what interviewers say. I mean, I mentioned in the book that certainly during much of the 70s, every time a Charles Shaw Murray or somebody would say, I've got a feeling, isn't John I'm Only Dancing actually about Kierkegaard? Then Bowie would go, yeah, that's it, you've got it, exactly. And it wouldn't matter what Charlie Murray or whoever, you guys maybe at that point, had said, he would agree. And it's a way of deflecting. And also the interviewer goes away thinking,
Well, immensely flattered. I've explained David Bowie to David Bowie. Yeah, brilliant, the monkey guy would exist without me.
And meanwhile, the real David Bowie scurries off untouched.
He's chuckling. Yes. Adopting a new persona. What did he tell you that you didn't... Do you remember anything he told you that was a revelation to you? You know, that you didn't know? I mean, I remember something about the Ziggy Stardust character that he invented. I remember
Ziggy Stardust, the Ziggy Stardust character has got about 8 different origins now. I'm losing count of the origins of the Ziggy Stardust character.
Obviously, you told him what the origins were.
Yes.
It
was Kierkegaard. With the haircut of Charles Sean Murray.
You've just ruined my exclusive now.
So amongst the many origins of Ziggy Stardust, you used to get the train in from Bromley on the South London line into Victoria, Waterloo, whatever, and you would pass the shops around South London, and there was a big tailor's shop called Ziggy Somethings. Presumably a very old Jewish tailor by the sound of it, you know.
Yeah.
So the name Ziggy stuck in his mind from the... Not Iggy. Although he'll tell another interviewer, it's based on... It's Iggy.
Yeah.
I took it from Iggy, of course. Just as the character is based on Iggy.
Yes.
Or else to say the character is based on Mark Bolan. Stardust is... He's pretty consistent about Stardust being taken from the legendary Stardust Cowboy.
That's right.
Or the Ledge, as he calls him, who was one of the outsider artists on Phillips at the same time as Bowie, whom he got to know very well, kind of slightly bizarre character, who wrote Gemini Spacecraft.
Yeah.
Isn't that his? Yeah. Whom Bowie was... the young Bowie was terrifically impressed by.
You mentioned Bolan. I'd forgotten all about that, because it was an incredible rivalry, wasn't there? I mean, one gets ahead before the other, and Bowie's then... I think Bolan's successful first, isn't he?
He is.
And then Bowie's immensely eaten up about it. And then there's that wonderful bit in Black Country Rock, which I'm sure he must have done as just a spontaneous thing, and it wasn't planned, but the final verse, doesn't he impersonate Bolan? And then there's that terrible thing at the end where I think Bolan's trying to come back, and he's got this... 1977, he's got a television show, and he's put on a massive amount of the old suet. Do you remember? And he's perspiring heavily, and I think, doesn't Bowie come back and help him on that show?
On the very last show, that's right.
His last show.
They jam, and extremely symbolically, Bolan falls off the stage in his excitement, and that's it. That's the end of the end.
And that is pretty much the last we see of
that. That is the last moment of his career.
That is symbolic.
He falls off the stage. Yeah.
And was that during the time? I mean, in 77. I mean, he was dying in September 77.
It was about a week before he died, I think.
Yeah.
But earlier than that, they had got together in a New York hotel room, fueled on naughty substances, and had come up with an idea. I think while they were watching A Clockwork Orange 14 times in a row or whatever, they come up with the idea of they were going to make a movie.
As you do.
And I can't remember it's in the book. I can't remember which way around it was.
What state would he be in?
Either Mark Bolan was going to direct the film, or he was going to write it, and Bowie was going to do the other thing, and they were going to make an album together. Now, of course, for Bowie, this was just one more cocaine-fueled flight of fancy, and he'd forgotten about it within 30 seconds. Poor old Mark Bolan shopped this idea around the British pop press for the next 3 years, promising. And of course, being Mark Bolan, he had to make it sound bigger and bigger every time, so that by 77, it's sounding as if it's going to
be a massive,
it's going to be the most extensive, extravagant album of all time. And earlier that year, the two of them did get together.
The disappointment of its appearance.
But the pair of them did get together in a studio in 77, and actually. The little fragments that are around on YouTube, I think, again, you can hear just the hint of maybe they could have made something like The Idiot, the Bolan version of The Idiot. But he's showing off so much that you can also hear Bowie getting increasingly pissed off with him and going, let's move on to the next one. So it was destined never to happen.
Have you heard a lot of outtakes and things in the course of researching this book?
I've heard everything I possibly can, yeah.
And how did you get to hear that stuff?
The same way as everybody else does. Bootlegs.
Illegally?
Illegally, of course, yeah. Yep.
And what have you heard that hasn't been released that you thought was particularly illuminating?
Illuminating rather than particularly brilliant. There's a song called...
Well, it's the conversations in the background and stuff, isn't it? Yeah.
There's a song called How Lucky You Are, alias Miss Peculiar, I think. I better check this up, because if I get it wrong, you're going to get 5,000 emails about
much
it.
Much as I enjoyed your guest on Tuesday.
He knows, he knows absolutely nothing.
Yes. Yeah. I could have written that book.
Please. Yeah. How Lucky You Are, alias Miss Peculiar, which is his first piano song. And his songwriting changed immeasurably when he discovered the piano. And that's the difference between Man of Soul of the World and Hunky Dory.
Yes.
Two-thirds
yes.
of Hunky Dory is written on the piano.
Fascinating, yeah. I didn't know that.
And I describe in the book the way that, like anybody who can't play the piano who wants to, who works out, oh, three fingers, you can do a chord, one finger, bass, yeah, and then you just run down.
Pop piano, yeah, style, yeah.
But that was good enough to give...
So that changed the way you composed
completely,
it.
And that just that idea of taking three fingers in the right hand, one in the left hand, playing around on the keyboard, maybe just moving down what sounds nice, that gave him changes, Life on Mars, Oh, You Pretty Things, you know, which is not bad for a first experiment
Brilliant.
With the piano.
I never realised. That's why they've got those very pronounced bass parts, don't they? They're all hooked around a bit. That's fascinating.
But the very first of those is this awful song, which sounds like a Eurovision Song Contest, Reject, Miss Peculiar, which I think he sent to Tom Jones, who must just have thought this was a joke, you know.
Hopeless.
Obviously, 5 years later, Tom would have been champing at the bit to record it. But.
Yeah, well, he'd send songs to Frank Sinatra or anybody that he could possibly try and place them with. Again, that's how he saw himself. You know, he'd either write musicals. Ziggy Stardust began
Tim Pan Alley, what you
said. As an idea for a West End musical, you know, before it morphed into something else. But part of the reason he was so adventurous at that stage was, I think he also had nothing to lose. He thought, pretty much everything I do turns to dust anyway. Yeah. So, you know, what have I got to lose? I'll try a different tack next time around. But once he was successful, as you say, even once he was successful, he was still not tempted to repeat the formula. Mm. And that was what... In a way, that was how he captured people's imagination in the 70s, the way the Beatles had in the 60s, because no previous success would trammel them into feeling obliged to repeat it.
Yeah.
They didn't care. You know, it was scorched earth every time. You know, we started fresh with the next record.
What did you learn from the process then? So you spent, I'm trying to imagine, how long did you take locked up in an attic somewhere thinking about David Bowie all day, every day? How long did it take to write for a start? Beyond their madness lies.
The research was about a year, of which 2 or 3 months was literally just listening to David Bowie and going, what's that? You know, is that a celeste? Is that a harmonium? Not that it's necessary in the book, but it all just gave me a sense of what was going on. And then the actual writing process was the shortest bit. That was 3 months of very intensive sort of 9 to 5 or 9 to 9, just soaking myself in the stuff. But trying to think myself not only into what was happening in the studio, how he had written the song, what musical and lyrical influences were in play, but also psychologically what each song meant to him. And obviously, if you're talking about songs about madness, for example, you have to get into the stuff about his family. But also what each song or what each peer represented to him in terms of how he saw himself in the world, his career. And so... It was almost like a process of, it sounds ridiculous, but trying to become David Bowie just during that period, to read the stuff that he was reading, to think, okay, what records was he listening to? That's interesting. Oh, there's a thing from a weird late 60s singer-songwriter thing that I remember. Oh, there's something else from the same record. He obviously played that. Discovering in the late 70s that he obviously spent most of his days listening to John Lennon, Plastic Ono Band.
Oh, really?
Because it's such a... When you have that in your head, you can suddenly hear the influence on Heroes, on the remake of Space Oddity that he does at the end of the 70s, and on Scary Monsters as well. So trying to pick up those themes, not in a sort of train spottery, ha-ha, I've caught you way, but to work out where he was and to understand what he thought he was trying to do.
And there's the one song... In researching it and looking at the background of the song, because the book brilliantly puts into context all these particular tracks, where the ideas came from, a lot of the musical background and their evolution, their gestation, etc. There's the one song that seems different to you, because you now know so much more about it.
I think as a pair, Quicksand and Station to Station, which maybe are not obvious ones to go together, but I think they both represent him... testing out the limits of his personality, of his knowledge, testing out the limits of how he can exist in the world, philosophy, the occult, what kind of things can I believe in? And in Quicksand, he uses that as a way to sort of kickstart his creativity. And then the song is almost like a list of all the possibilities that he could have followed. Now, Station to Station, it's a much more confused man who's doing that. But basically, he still manages to cram... all sorts of influences, again, the occult, religion, literature, the Shakespeare, all sorts of things, and Kraftwerk and whatever else. So those two songs are two extremely different areas of his career where he crammed in as much of what's going on in my head as possible.
And Paul, we're going around the table now. We're going to have a favourite Bowie song from this period. Fraser, you're next, so prepare.
From
China. Go. We can't have that. It's on the boat. What do you think?
I love almost every song from the 70s without that exception. But my favourite would be, although it's disappointingly obvious, is Heroes. Title track of Heroes. It's just the most. It's just the most enormous, uplifting song. It alters my mood within seconds of hearing it every time, and it never wears out. It's amazing; it never wears out for me.
Fraser Lurie.
5 years.
5 years, very good.
Yeah, I like it. The epic nature of it.
Yes, Fraser's just passed me a piece of paper with a few questions from the Massive. Peter, I'm going to address these to both of you. Actually,
does Pete not get to choose his favourite song?
He sort of did.
I sort of did.
Did before, but it was really the favourite song as of after writing the book. Was there a favourite song before the book?
Maybe even after the song. In terms of what I actually would like to hear, I suppose Young Americans, I think, as a performance. But what links all these songs we've mentioned, and what people never say enough, is what a fantastic singer he is.
Yeah,
and what a fantastic backing vocals he does. That's something that is always overlooked as well. He's up there with the Beatles when it comes to that.
Absolutely. And so, look, Nick Horton, 16, writes with this query. Thank you for this, Nick Horton, 16. Was Bowie's work improved by drugs? That's quite a good question, actually. How different would it have been without it?
Does he mean it?
The panel.
Does he mean it as a listener or as a performer? Oh,
Nick Horton himself lit up like a Christmas tree. Like a pinball machine while listening to everybody. I don't know. Paul, what do you think? I mean, it's pretty the pattern.
Yeah, of course, one always shies away from the conclusion that taking drugs was good for the music. In Bowie's case, it's a little bit disturbing, because if you were to sort of map a graph of drug intake against perceived musical quality, anyway, they are horribly similar looking. For me personally, anyway, although I like all of Bowie's music, it absolutely peaks around Station to Station time low, when I think he was beginning to clean up to some extent. But this also, and Young Americans, and this was, as far as I can gather, this was the absolute peak of his drug intake as well. I'm not saying the drugs caused the musical, the inconsistent genius to manifest itself, but they did overlap to a huge degree.
Don't try this at home, folks.
Yes.
I'd just like to add to that briefly that I think what the drugs did was enable Bowie to do very quickly what he was trying to do throughout the decade, which was access his creativity in the most sort of seamless, painless way possible. And if taking industrial quantities of cocaine would enable him to do that, then he would do it.
Yeah, there might be, like the old phrase, in vino veritas, sometimes people drink a bit, yeah. It makes them say something which is not necessarily rubbish, it may be true, it's something that it's wouldn't honesty. Actually say. Mm. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. That's true. Upbeat Nick says, is it time for a tin machine reappraisal? Who is, to this decade, what Bowie was to the 70s? Oh, sorry, it's a different question, which I've phrased wrongly. Who is, to this decade, what Bowie was to the 70s? Tin Machine, I don't know.
Tin Machine.
We kind of draw the veil over that, don't we?
Go back and listen to the records. The singing is fantastic.
Oh, right, OK.
The second album, particularly. I'm not a great fan of Tin Machine to listen to, but Bowie's singing is amazing.
Oh, right, OK. And what about... several people here, actually, have written about Bowie's first album, which was called, I think, David Bowie, was on the Derham label in 1967. It gets a lot of flack, but I'm very fond of it personally. It says Andrew F.
Yeah, me too.
It's a good record, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think, Paul, you said the same thing, haven't you? You like the early stuff as well. It doesn't make much sense in terms of what came afterwards, but in terms of what he had been doing up to that point, all the stuff we've been talking about, the entertainment, the Tim Panelli, it makes perfect sense.
I got one last one here from the great Dogface Boy. Hello, Dogface Boy. We're big fans of his. Yes, Heathen is great, but One Outside is the gem of his last few years of active service. Discuss and show you're working.
It's a fascinating... I say in the book, if it had come out after Heroes, it would have been greeted as, you know, such a huge step in that progression.
Yeah.
Instead of which, I think he fell off with Lodger. Unfortunately, when it came out, there wasn't the audience there for it. There was an audience for Bowie as an icon,
yeah.
as a memory of what he had been in the 70s and 80s. Now, as a superstar, there wasn't really a mass audience for him as an experimental artist anymore.
We haven't heard from him since you interviewed him, actually, Paul, for the Word. You told him something about Kierkegaard, and he went weeping off into a corner somewhere. We haven't ever resisted. He felt he'd achieved all he needed to achieve. The rumours, obviously, the ridiculous rumours, some of them are rather grim and have a medical dimension to them, that he had a heart attack. Actually, no, he did have a heart attack.
He's not
physically well enough to get back on stage. But what, Paul, I'm going to you first. What do you think is actually happening? Or is he just retired looking after children?
The last I heard from his people, a couple of months ago was that he was living quietly in New York and doing the school run for his daughter, Alexandra, and pottering away on his book,
he's writing a memoir, isn't he?
Memoir. I don't think it's a straight autobiography.
Do you think so?
I've got a feeling it's going to be old lyrics from his cupboard, and he's going to write a few captions rather than 300,000 words on how I really created Ziggy Stardust.
I think the dread phrase non-linear may come into play in this context.
Oh, I can't cope with that.
But he has been he has had some bad health, and there's a YouTube thing, a video of him doing a fashion show in New York a few years ago. He performs Life on Mars. And I tell this to everybody, you know, look it up on YouTube. David Bowie, Fashion Rocks was the concert, Life on Mars. And he comes on. It's terribly poignant. If you're an old Bowie fan, as I was saying before, it's really the first time I can recall ever seeing him. And he actually looks his age. You know, he aged extraordinarily well. He never grew fat or bald.
That's right, absolutely.
And in this, he still looks great, but he looks old and frail. He looks battered, actually. He's got a black eye and his arms in plaster. But knowing
a black eye doesn't
knowing the old it? Show business queen,
he's got a good look.
it's probably all faked.
Yes, it probably was.
But it's a tremendous.
Probably got up that morning.
It's an awfully affecting performance, and he has Mike Garson on piano, his only accompaniment, and they pitch it down an octave below the original pitch of the first recording. It's tremendously moving to watch.
Well, we should really end with a sort of Radio 2 style slick plug for the book, which I could provide, actually, The Man Who Sold the World. When is it out, actually?
Next week.
Next week.
End of September.
The Man Who Sold the World, David Bowie and the 1970s by Peter Tosh is out very soon. And how fantastic of you both to come in. It's been an absolute joy.
Thank you.
If you've been affected by any of the issues in this podcast, go to wordmagazine.co.uk or apply at your newsagent every month.